It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's talk legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law, and Cecil Harvell & Wes Collins in the studios with us. Good morning, gentlemen.
We are here, Ben, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Yeah.
First program of the new year.
Okay, and what are we talking about today?
Let's talk about deed restrictions and what that means, Ben.
Okay.
Okay. You know, as we begin the new year, we all know that one of the most prideful kind of aspects of ownership that anyone happens to have is their home place.
Sure.
Maybe their family farm,
mm-hmm.
Property that they own, that their family has owned for many years, you know, on the bay or the river or the sound or whatever, the family camp.
Correct.
There's a lot of pride, a lot of comfort that comes with property ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Wes and I are confronted often, Ben, with questions concerning, this property means a great deal to our family.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want my son or daughter to be able to sell it.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Or I want to make sure that this property is always used for a certain purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't want it to be developed. The list is kind of endless. You know, it can be as simple as I don't want those particular oak trees on that property to
mm-hmm.
ever be cut down
right.
or destroyed. There's a cemetery on the property, and I want that family cemetery to always be protected and to be maintained. So there's kind of an endless list of wants, if you will, concerning our real property. And clients often ask us to place these kinds of wants, if you will, restrictions in certain deeds or in conveyances that they might make, even by will.
Mm-hmm.
They will will the property to their children with these particular descriptions, okay, that the children cannot sell the property. Well, the problem with these restrictions, Ben, is that in it to be direct, the law doesn't support them.
Right. Right.
They are known as alienation of transfer rights. The law does not support the burdening of real property.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we begin with the analysis. And then we kind of have to find that the burden is reasonable, that it will not unduly devalue the property in any way, things of that nature, in order to make these things become reality. And so let's kind of talk about this a little bit and how this kind of comes into play on a day-to-day basis at the law firm.
I would imagine this comes in, has its basis in the standard in North Carolina of highest and best use of property.
That's right. And the most common restrictions on properties are those that we have discussed here at the radio program before, which are restrictive covenants that are placed on the property within the context of a development.
Right, right.
And our law does look at those
mm-hmm.
with some sense of enforceability. But even those have to be reasonable
mm-hmm.
in all respects. And they usually are found to be reasonable because the argument is that it is a controlled environment. It is a developed community,
mm-hmm.
and we don't want there to be, you know, a basketball goal in every single front yard, and
mm-hmm.
we don't want trailers and boats to be allowed to be parked in the front yard, and we want all mailboxes to be, you know, the
uniform,
same color,
yeah.
same uniform design, things of that nature, because we're within the context of a community at that point, and there is this overriding desire to maintain the value of the community at whole. The law comes in and most times supports these restrictions as long, of course, as long as they're reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
In a private context, that becomes a bit more challenging and a little bit more difficult. And the one that is the most challenging at all is the one where a parent says, I do not want my children to be able to sell the property.
Right. Want it to stay in the family.
Want it to stay in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And that is difficult as a lawyer to, you know, what does that really mean? It's got to stay in the family. Well, who is family? Are wives that marry in, that have been married for 50 years to family members family? You know, they're not the blood line, but they certainly are now part of the family and have been for many, many years. When we're asked to look at issues such as that, the lawyer brain in we folks, you know, projects out many, many years. We have a tendency to think like that. And we think, well, we know who son and daughter is right now. But who are going to be the spouses of the grandchildren? And who are going to be the spouses of the great-grandchildren? And let's talk more about, you know, the next and the future generations.
Right.
And that's where we can run into a problem.
I would imagine, again, is the will, even after the assets have been dispersed, does the will have any power any longer and the estate's been closed?
Well, you know, the will doesn't have power, you know, after the estate's been closed, because obviously the will is going to control the probate assets at the time of the death, you know, unless there is a restriction in the will itself, such as something like, I pass this real property to so-and-so subject to this restriction, because you can convey title by deed, you can convey it by your will. There could be a testamentary trust that is in the actual will that carries beyond. So it depends on how the will itself is drafted. But these real property restrictions on deeds, you know, it really goes back to the fact that, you know, whoever has title to the property can place whatever restrictions they want to on the restriction. I mean, on the title, as long as it's supported by the law. I mean, it can't be, you know, something that is discriminatory or, you know, something like that, or something that's not ascertainable. But really where we see this, in my opinion, more often is really years and years ago. It's more of kind of like a common law thing, possibility of reverter in the event you don't use the property in a certain way, it reverts back to the previous owner, that type thing. You don't see it quite as much, as Cecil was saying, here these days. Now it's useful and it's a tool that us attorneys have in our toolbox in the event that the client expresses some interest to restrict the title. And we, you know, but there are also other ways to do that, whether it be through a trust, you know, whether it be through, you know, something more along the lines instead of a reverter type language, you know, these covenants. I put a covenant on the property. And again, these restrictions on use of real property, really are strictly construed, and where we see them more often is going to be in the subdivision context in these days.
Right.
You know, and it's not as though, you know, the deed transfers with a single restriction with regard to the use of a subdivision. Most people who live in a subdivision know that the covenants or declarations are usually pretty voluminous. You know, they're 20 pages, 30 pages long.
Right.
And, you know, it's, as we said on the program before, if you're going to buy a property in a subdivision or in a development in which covenants exist, then you need to read those things because really they, in most cases, are fully enforceable, and you're going to have to, you know, comply with the terms, whether it relates to the size of your house, you know, whether you can park your boat in the driveway, you know, the color of your house, your mailbox, whether you can have an outbuilding, you know, it could be, you know, one of many, 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 many things. And a lot of folks don't realize that. And then they buy the property and then they get the letter from the homeowners association saying, well, you're in breach. And then the next thing you know, they call a lawyer and here we are saying, well, that is enforceable. So. So that's a form of this type of restriction on use of real property.
But when it comes to a single piece of property that's not under a development, that's not under covenants, then your opportunity to restrict its use in the future is...
You do have that right.
You do have that right.
That's right. If you hold title, you have the right to restrict it.
You're on your own, so as we say, but that's not not bad. That just
right.
is the way it is.
Right. So in a sense, you can create your own covenant.
You can. You right. can. Now, one of the other permutations of this conversation is the, you know, well, I want my spouse to be able to live there, you know, and have a life estate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then maybe I even want my children to have a life estate, and I want the title to eventually vest in my grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
This is not unusual. This is not
right.
an unusual
yeah.
request or want from a client.
Okay, we'll get to that in just mm-hmm. a second here. But your calls and our questions about deed restrictions and about how you maintain or pass along property, you can call us right now at 800-818-2255 or these local numbers.
247-7282 or 353-4674.
And we'll have more with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law, who bring you Let's Talk Legal every Tuesday morning. Hey, welcome back here to Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station. Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins and Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins talking about deed restrictions. And Cecil, you had brought up the life estate.
Yes. And of course, what we have to then discuss with our client is things like, well, who will pay the taxes?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to maintain the property? Who's going to make repairs to the property? Is the life tenant going to be able to afford to do those things?
Mm-hmm.
Because if they cannot afford to do that, then that creates a legal dilemma between the life tenant and the remainder people, the remainder men or mm-hmm. women, eventually, because the life tenant has a duty under the law to not allow the property to go into waste mm-hmm. or to disrepair, things of that nature. So it's conceptually a nice thing for a client to think about, but practically we have to make sure that it's going to work. Okay.
I think a lot of people may go into it thinking that it's like a landlord-tenant relationship, only it's free rent. You know, so they don't feel like they have that responsibility.
Mm-hmm. But you run into issues like the life tenant might take the position, well, why should I do the following to the property? After all, I don't completely own the property. I
mm-hmm.
just live here.
Right.
If I go and improve the roof, if I go and do certain improvements to the property, you know, I'm really not going to have the benefit of it. I'm using my money to improve the benefit for the children. And maybe the children aren't her children. The children are the children
right.
of the former spouse. So these are practical considerations and conversations that we really have to have with folks. I've mentioned before here on the program, Ben, that you know that we work and we accomplish the goal of the client in every way that we can.
Mm-hmm.
But when the word "I want to give my spouse a life estate in the property" comes up in conference with my clients, you know, there's a little bit of a shudder down the spine. Okay,
right,
you
right.
know, okay, all right. Now let's begin to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
We usually talk about other things first, and then we're going to come back and talk about that because that we have a lot of files where the life estate, remainder interest estate, and the conflicts between the two are very, very real, kind of where the rubber hits the road.
The life estate is actually an asset, though. I mean,
it is.
Yeah.
It has value.
Mm-hmm.
It has
sold.
It can be sold. It has surprising value, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Even for a 70 or 80 year old person, it's based on the actuarial tables, and then a formula is applied to the fair market value to find out the value of the life estate. But it is not insignificant by any means. So many times the life estate value is greater than the remainder interest.
Hmm. Okay.
So, you know, just kind of a big picture, life estate, remainder interest, you know, Cecil used those words. They kind of roll off his tongue because we use mm-hmm. them so often, but I know that, you know, that maybe it's Greek to some folks listening. You know, the life estate, of course, is the right for someone to have use and possession of the property, and it's an exclusive right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, no one can kick them out of the property, can remove them from the property, but that life estate holder has certain duties as well. I mean, they have to maintain the property to a reasonable degree, avoid waste, as Cecil indicated. And that duty is to these remainder holders.
Mm-hmm.
The remainder holders are the individuals who, would receive, or an individual would receive, the property upon the death of the life estate holder.
Right, right.
The tax bill still comes in the name of the life tenant. If mm-hmm. anyone out there has a life estate, they know that that tax bill states LT on it, life tenant, but it still comes to you and you mm-hmm. still have to pay it.
Right.
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 And one of the things, again, that we take into consideration is that if we're going to leave a life estate to a spouse, you know, it could be, for example, a second marriage, and we're wanting to leave the property eventually to the children, let's say the husband's children of a previous marriage, but we want our surviving spouse to have a right to live in the home.
Right.
We do want to make sure, as Cecil indicated, that that surviving spouse has enough asset to be able to maintain the property, you know, to be able to pay the taxes, to maintain mm-hmm. the insurance, to pay the utilities, mm-hmm. you know, just so that is something that we take into consideration as well. And
now,
then
if they don't, yep. I mean, is there a way to work that out with the remainder of it?
Well, a lot of times when, you know, you end up in that situation, the life tenant is forced to work it out mm-hmm. with the remainderman. Because mm-hmm. if the remainderman is upset with the life tenant because the life tenant is not reasonably maintaining the property, is creating waste, is not insuring the property,
mm-hmm.
Then there could be, you know, potentially it could get to a litigation context. I mean, mm-hmm. let's say the life tenant can't afford hazard insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say the house burns down. Well, then the remainderman, they have a claim
yeah.
against that life tenant for failure to reasonably maintain the property and insure the property.
But they're out of
house.
They
could sue them. But if this life tenant doesn't have any assets,
mm-hmm.
then what are they going to get? I mean,
right.
maybe this life tenant only has a life estate in the dirt then,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. And that eventually, you know, goes to the remainder anyway. So
they're very tricky, then, aren't they?
It is. The relationship between the two is not free lunch for the life tenant. It mm-hmm. is the right to possession, but certain obligations come with that.
Okay. More to come in a moment. We're talking about deed restrictions and the things you can and cannot do with your property. You can give us a call at 800-818-2255 or these local numbers.
247-7282 or 353-4674.
You can go online to harvellandcollins.com and find out more about Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law. Bring you the Let's Talk Legal every Tuesday morning. We'll have more to come in a moment. Hey, welcome back to Let's Talk Legal here with the Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law, online at harvellandcollins.com, talking about deed restrictions. And Wes, you mentioned something briefly about reversion, and you said that's not used that much anymore.
Possibility of a reverter.
Yeah.
I mean, that takes you back to the first week or two in real property class in law school.
right.
Yeah. But, you know, we just don't see it that much anymore, but it is a restriction on real property. And what it is basically, it's a restriction that the owner puts on the property, indicating that if you use the property for this purpose, that's approved. In the event that you don't, or mm-hmm. if you use it for some purpose that I don't approve, then it would revert back to the grantor.
Like somebody may give property to an organization to run a camp, but if they decide to sell it for a development.
Right. Or, you know, I give this property to my son. However, you may not sell alcoholic beverages from this property. Mm. In the event you do, it goes back to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something like that. You know, this, but we don't see a lot of that anymore, but it's in the law, in the old cases that we look at. And it's still good law.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the usefulness of it is not, it's not as prevalent as it was back maybe in the 1800s, 1900s,
mm-hmm.
you know, but there are other ways to deal with it too. I mean, we use trust more often,
mm-hmm.
You know, covenants, you know, those type of things. But back to the life estate remainder, mm-hmm. dynamic there, I think that's interesting. I want to talk briefly about, the ability to sell your interest.
Right.
Because if you have a remainder interest,
mm-hmm.
I mean, what that is that's an interest that you're going to have in the property that has not yet vested yet.
Right.
I mean, it's yours, but it is not an interest that you can't act
upon it. Really.
Well, you can sell it if mm-hmm. you want to, but what you're selling is you're selling a future right
mm-hmm.
in that property. I mean, it really is a current right, but it's a future right that you have the right to possession upon the death of the life tenant.
Right.
So, I mean, if the life tenant is 25 years old
and in good shape,
mm-hmm.
then the likelihood that someone is going to want to buy that remainder interest so that there's a possibility they receive the property in mm-hmm. 60 years mm-hmm. probably isn't that high. However, in the event that you're interested in selling your remainder interest and the life tenant is 90, then that the value of the remainder interest is going to be much higher, of mm-hmm. course, because the likelihood that the life tenant is going to pass and that life estate is going to be extinguished by the death is going to be, you know, obviously much higher. Same thing with the life estate. Mm-hmm. I mean, if a 25-year-old has a life estate and real property is in good shape, then it's pretty high value. It's basically a right to use the property
right
until the death of that life tenant. Now, that's a dynamic that people don't understand that much. The mm-hmm. the life estate interest runs from the death of whoever holds it.
Mm-hmm.
So if a life estate is conveyed to a certain person,
right,
and that person sells that life estate interest to someone else, whenever that first person passes away,
that life
estate it's ends. Gone.
Yeah.
And then it goes to the remainder. The title then passes to the
remainder. Can a person who holds a life estate borrow against it? Does it have value in that fashion?
Yes, but would a lender
yeah, right.
loan on something like that?
Right.
Probably not. No, the lender is almost always going to want, you know, fee simple title, first
right.
position in most mm-hmm. cases, and have the right to foreclose on the entirety of the property, not just the life estate that's
exactly.
going to go away one day.
In conclusion, Ben, because we just have a minute, what I'd like for our listeners to kind of conclude on is just that if you have one of these wants there, then it is very important that you go to an attorney and really discuss all of the pros and the cons.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine to put it out there on the table, but there are lots of things that need to be talked about, not just with the life estate, but just in general.
Right.
Had a client recently that wanted his property in Beaufort down east to go into a trust for his grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And then I asked the question, well, who's going to pay the taxes every year,
mm-hmm.
the upkeep on the property? Well, you know, I think that my sons will do that.
Mm-hmm. You think?
Well, what if the sons aren't still living?
Yeah.
You know, the sons don't own the property. The trust does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were some things we have to talk about.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And, that's what we lawyers do.
All right. And you give them a call again if you want to make that appointment at 252-726-9050, 726-9050, 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City, and online at harvellandcollins.com.